Welcome back, loyal listeners in Prez, Cork, Ireland, and indeed all around the globe. The boys are back in town. I'm Stephen Delaney.
And I'm Matthew Reardon.
And we are very excited to bring you the first installment of the fourth season of PBC Podcast. I know for one that I'm delighted to be part of this year's team. Matthew, how are you feeling about the year ahead?
I'm thrilled, Stephen, and I cannot wait for this episode to begin, and indeed the season ahead. The torch has officially been passed on from last year's hosts, Sam Hernan and Brian O'Leary, and it's our job to now maintain the bar at a really high broadcasting level. Previous students here in Presentation Brothers College on the Mardyke have set. And what better way to do this than with a Christmas cracker of an opening episode?
Absolutely, Matthew, and what a bumper lineup we have. To begin, we talk coffee culture and meet the man behind the ever-popular barista course in transition year in Prez. Then on to what is now a staple of PBC Podcast, our big interview. We spoke to two ex-professional sportsmen who now teach in Prez. That's a fantastic listen. Staying with sport, we hear from an up-and-coming MMA star in Prez and indeed a national champion.
That's not enough to stimulate your interest. We go down memory lane with a man now in his 92nd year as he reminisces on his childhood growing up on the Grand Parade here in Cork and Christmas in the 1930s and 40s. Then, the festive spirit really kicks off as we hear an original radio drama adaptation written and performed by our own students here in Prez. Any clues for our listeners, Stephen?
Bah humbug is all I can say for now, Matthew, but do stay tuned. It's great fun.
It is for sure. We close out on this episode with a real Christmas musical treat then, Stephen. We weren't present for this recording, but I heard they really knocked it out of the park.
They surely did, but maybe we won't give away all the details to our listeners just yet. All I can say is it's worth the wait. Anyway, time to get the show on the road. To kickstart this season, we go to Emmett Brady, a roving reporter who headed over to Café Depeche on Lancaster Quay with our sound engineer, Oisin Tobin, to interview owner and barista Humphrey Porter. Take it away, Emmett.
Welcome to the PBC Podcast, Humphrey. We're so glad to finally have you on.
Thanks, Emmett.
You're a hard man to pin down for an interview, but we've trapped you in the storeroom, so hopefully we'll get our money's worth now. So how long have you been a barista?
About 22 years. So there isn't a governing body that licenses baristas. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably one of the small little downfalls of the industry. But when we opened, I opened the first one 21 years ago in Cork. And it was pre a cafe culture. There was only one other cafe in Cork at the time. But when we did open, it was quite difficult to get product because suppliers, it was such a new industry and suppliers weren't catering for the cafe industry at the time.
So you've kind of seen like the rise and fall of almost coffee in Ireland. Like you've been through it all, if you know what I mean. You've kind of survived. It's a bit of like a bare knuckle brawl in Cork because now there's a cafe on every single street, but there's still Café Depeche and they're always... will be Café Depeche, if you know what I mean.
Because we've kind of built a regular customer base as well. What we've noticed over the years is that all the customers have got to know each other, and there's a social aspect to it, definitely.
Has it been hard kind of fighting against pub culture? Because obviously that's really like ingrained in, I feel like, Irish society. So I feel like, did you have to kind of battle against it at all? Has there any been real, like, any pubs that you would say have kind of... you've ever had to like not worry about, because obviously it's different kind of things you're trying to do, but would you say it's been a hard kind of get people into the cafe at the start?
I think from a daytime business, I think cafes are probably a step ahead, to be honest. But we've definitely seen over the years that it's quite difficult. We used to open until 10 o'clock in the evening, and it's quite difficult to put even 10 people into a cafe past 7 o'clock in the evening.
Just people winding down for bed, and I feel like caffeine's almost like the last thing you would want. Unless, do you have it open at night times for people like working nights? Would you?
No, not anymore. No.
Fair enough. It's just more work to you. What about coffee interested you originally? Like, I know obviously you wanted to create a pub without the pub, or like a pub without the alcohol, but was it coffee always you wanted to specialise in?
Yeah, I think I remember as a young kid heading into Patrick Street with my mum, and my dad would be working, and we'd go and visit him in the pub, and you'd always kind of get a a cup of coffee at the counter with a snack. And as a kid, it was a treat. And I think it kind of grew from there. And as I said before we opened, there wasn't really a coffee culture. So the idea was to offer the future, really, in this. You know, things like flat whites weren't available in Ireland at the time when we opened, so we were actually the first to serve flat whites. Chai lattes were also another product that we brought in with us. We started selling the likes of matcha tea about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I even remember when we used to import San Pellegrino direct from Italy, mm-hmm. because it just wasn't on the Irish market. So now it's on every shop and restaurant mm-hmm. across the country. But I think over the last 20 years, we've definitely seen that the world has got a lot smaller in terms of product.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely more difficult to find unique products at the moment.
No, sure, you definitely had a good foundation built in when all these big companies like Starbucks and Costa decided to like sink their fangs into Cork, especially. I feel like they're everywhere nowadays. But would you say they've been a big competition, or would you be more worried about the more local coffee shops like Insomnia or Gloria Jeans or even Green Frog just down the road? Would you say they're any competition, or is it the big brands that you're worried about?
I think for us, because we've seen such a change in the market, for me, anybody that has a cash register at the moment is a competitor,
mm-hmm.
not just cafes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is, I think, a tightening of the purse strings, and there's a shortage of money out there. The big chains, the Starbucks, the Costas, I think they are very necessary for our success. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely a place for them. I think what they do and how they help us is that because of their budgets, they can introduce the drinks into the market for us.
Mm-hmm.
They can educate the younger population, and then it's up to us as an independent to piggyback that and to offer the same similar product of a better quality.
So how did you build your brand? Would you say it was from just getting to know your customers, or just getting in at the right time, getting there first, just adapting over time? Or how would you say you stayed where you are as a shop or as a cafe?
Over the 21 years, we've seen a lot of cafes come and go. Mm-hmm. Lots of cafes come and go. I think have very good customer service. But I think you also got to understand your customer and your mm-hmm. customer base. You got to understand your city. You got to understand your product. And I think more than anything else, while being true to the core value of the business, which is for us coffee and chocolate, I think you also have to continuously develop your business. You can't mm-hmm. just sell the same. And I think that's one of the problems that I see at the moment, is that there's a lot of businesses and it's just... it's putting stuff out for the sake of putting stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's not about popularity. And I think there's a little bit of that after sneaking into the coffee industry, especially mm-hmm. in Ireland. I see cafes getting awards with the amount of hashtags, where for me, the businesses that are still trading 20 years on, they're the ones I would be more interested in looking at, because they're the ones that have... In the current era, have come mm-hmm. through floods and come through recessions, come through COVID. So they definitely know how to adapt, as opposed to getting a lot of hashtags or likes on mm-hmm. social media. And because of that, we also kind of went down the road of selling quality.
Mm-hmm.
And even when business gets tough, I think it's really important then to really be consistent and stick with your own values.
No, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. I've actually been doing the barista course here in Cafe Depeche for the last 3 months, and I honestly only made that Depeche Mode connection like 2 weeks ago, I think, because I was I think you have all the posters there, and I was like, Depeche Mode, oh, that's funny. And then I started thinking, I was like, oh, Cafe Depeche. I don't know why I just never like made that connection. But no, because even just the way you have the main shop decorated, it's just... It has a lot of stuff from it. You do have posters up as well. I think it's lovely in there, but it has a really nice atmosphere. But speaking of COVID, how would you say you adapted to COVID as a shop or as multiple shops? Or how did you proceed when COVID happened?
I suppose we were kind of in a unique situation. We do some outside catering for the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So we stood up and stood in, continue that supply. And I know that there was a difficulty in sourcing product that we were able to get for the hospital. So I think that kind of kicked it off for us that we would continue to provide a service as long as we were physically able to. In 2009, we were affected by the floods in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So the front of the shop actually collapsed. So when it was rebuilt, we put a window in as a hatch.
Mm-hmm.
That people would start purchasing the coffee through the hatch back in 2009. Mm-hmm. But it did take another 10 years for COVID for that to actually kick in, for people to understand buying through a hatch was the way forward. So I spoke with my staff, and between us, we decided that we'd keep it going and we'd keep training. And we spoke to suppliers, and again, they told us as long as we'd stay open, they'd keep supplying us as well. So we were quite lucky and unique in that situation that we traded through it.
So would you say takeaway, when it comes to Café de Pêche, would takeaway coffees be more the thing, or would people like to sit in and kind of just... Because I know you have a lot of seating, you have the back room as well, and it's a lovely place to just sit down and have a coffee. But would you say people have kind of kept on going with COVID? It's almost still in the back of their heads, and they just grab their coffee, head off to work.
I think this year is the first year since COVID that we've seen a return to normality, where people are coming back out and sitting down and having coffee, having meetings and stuff like that. And I think that was really only since the summertime that we noticed that. So we still push the takeaway, but we do also have the seating area then as well, where there's definitely a bit of a comeback on that.
You do also produce tons of, I'm looking at them now, so it just reminded me, you produce tons of like molds as well. Like you have a really cool Millennium Falcon one, which I think is incredible. But you also have all of these seasonal ones. You have the chocolate gingerbread houses. You have all of the, just the chocolate you make. Is that a big seller around Christmas time? Would you?
Yeah, chocolate's been a big part of the business since we opened up originally. Again, we found that over the years, there wasn't really anybody doing good quality chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And the chocolate brands that were available, the multinationals, were dropping the standard and quality of theirs. So from that point of view, we kind of went down the road of making our own bonbons and pralines. And now we do a lot of molds and centerpieces as well.
And the centerpieces, they'd be for gift baskets. They'd be, would just consumers be buying them, would you say? Or are they more for kind of mass, people would buy them in bulk, maybe like 50 of them and just hand them out type thing? Or how would it work?
Yeah, we take orders in the shop, in the cafe below for them. But what we do, I suppose, pre-COVID, what we notice is that parents and godparents were buying them for their kids for Christmas, instead of selection boxes. They were getting more value for money, and the quality was there as well. And you can use the chocolate as well for hot chocolate. So there was multi uses with us as well.
But would you say you kind of take advantage? Like, would you make the most of the holiday season? Like, I know you have some Christmassy drinks. You'd have what would you say sells the best during the Christmas time or during this season?
For us, definitely the chocolate during Christmas. But I think you got to be clever with the chocolate system as well, because when you come to the likes of Easter and stuff like that, we wouldn't really do a lot of chocolate because the multinationals would be pumping out the cheaper Easter eggs, which we just don't even try and compete with.
Fair enough, yeah.
again, we'd have our own niche market and our own customers will order what they want from us, and we make it ourselves so we can produce that for them.
So you've been kind of partners with Prez for how many years now? Because you run the barista course, you every single year for the TUI students, you do a half year and a full year for barista level 1 and 2. Have you been doing that a long time? Have you kind of enjoyed it?
Yeah, we've been doing it for about 7 years. Mm-hmm. It's been really good. Definitely seen progression of the students over the last 7 years, from the very first group that came in to where we are today. I think there's definitely a bright future there. Mm-hmm. In terms of the industry. And again, for me, it's good to get to meet you guys as well and educate you in the different types of coffee, because at the end of the day, you're the guys that are going to increase and improve the standard of the industry by knowing what you're ordering and knowing what you're buying. And you know that if you're getting a bad coffee, why it's a bad coffee.
No, I have to say, I've absolutely loved it the last 3 months. I'm almost a bit hooked on coffee now, and I feel like I don't know what I'm going to do now, because I'm not going to have... next week is our last week, I think, I'm going to have my exam, or tomorrow I have my exam, geez. And I don't know, I'm not ready for it, because I'm used to now drinking 7 cups of coffee in 1 day every week, and now I'm going to have to actually start paying money for them, and it's horrible. I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, I've taken up enough of your time, Humphrey. Thank you for that interview. That was great. It was nice seeing you. All right, bye, 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 bye.
Thanks again.
Fascinating interview there with Humphrey Porter. And well done, Emmett. Great job, Matthew, don't you think?
Definitely, Stephen. And great to hear about Mr. Caleb Sheehan's involvement in establishing the barista courses in TY. I know he was a key factor in getting this podcast module established too. So big shout out to Mr. Sheehan, if he's listening in. He's never far from our thoughts here in Prez. Now, what do we have next on PBC Podcast, Stephen?
Actually, Matthew, you're up next. For our listeners familiar with our format, it's time for the big interview. Matthew and Harry Galvin-Carty sat down with a live third-year audience in the reading room, our studio, to question two of our teachers here in Prez about their past professional sporting careers. One played with Munster from 2011 to 2017, while the other lined out for Cork City, Finn Harps and Waterford from 2011 to 2018. Step forward, Mr. Cian Bohan and Mr. John Kavanagh.
Very welcome today to be on the PBC podcast, Mr. Kavanagh and Mr. Bohan. We are both delighted to have you here for a good chat. Harry is going to start you off with a couple of questions.
All right, lads. Mr. Kavanagh, I'll start you off with questions. Just bring you back to when you were younger, you know. Where did you start playing GAA in soccer?
I suppose I would have been involved in sport from a very young age. 5, 6 and 7 really. Was when I always kind of had a hurley in my hand. And hurling was my kind of number one sport, I suppose, growing up. And then it came to about 11 or 12 and I started to play a little bit of soccer. Kind of at first really just kind of stay fit in the... During Christmas, I suppose, when the hurling and things wouldn't be going on. And it kind of just took off from there, really. Kind of made a few Cork squads for soccer at 12, 13s, which would have been the Kennedy Cup age. And it just kind of took off from there, really. But as I said, hurling always would have been my kind of number one growing up. But then obviously I had to make a decision kind of at 15, 16. I kind of had to pick one or the other.
And was there any kind of really influential person in your sports career growing up that made you make that decision or helped you make that decision in which way you wanted to go?
Well, there was a guy called Colm Tuig. Got me involved in soccer with Leaside Knockra.
Yeah.
He used to be on to me a lot to play. He was manager there. So he kind of had a big influence, really, I suppose, and kind of stuck with me right throughout, I suppose. Even when I moved on from Leaside Knockra and went to Ringman, he always would have followed me and kept in touch. So he was definitely a big influence, yeah.
And what about you, Mr. Bohan? Where did you start off playing rugby?
I actually only started playing rugby when I came to Prez.
Right.
Up to that point, I'd never touched rugby ball. It was all soccer, albeit not to the same level as Cav. I was kind of like, it was quite new. Again, like any first year when they come to the school, you know, promoting or being promoted kind of rugby as a way to make friends and stuff. Like, I think out of my school, my primary school, I was one of three that came here, so I didn't actually know anybody else really. So yeah, just started off rugby in prison first year just to try kind of fit in, make friends, and yeah, got gradually more serious as the years went on.
And did you always love rugby as much? Did you ever plan to go professional? Was it always like, as soon as you came to first year, started playing rugby, were you like, all right, I want to do this professionally, or did it just kind of happen?
Oh no, I was absolutely terrified of it at the start. Yeah. I still remember Mr. O'Keefe giving out to me for missing tackles, like, because I hated contact so much.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until, I would say, it wasn't until kind of fifth and sixth year, really, where I started to properly kind of fall in love with rugby. Professional was never in, like, that was never in my sights, never in my kind of stars. That didn't really kick off until, I'd say, just after I left school, that they even thought of that could be a possibility. So, yeah, I think, you know, through my school years, it was more so just about enjoying it. And I was lucky to be, you know, part of some very good teams in the school,
yeah,
have some very nice and encouraging coaches as well, and that kind of kept me involved.
And when you did go professional, what was the setup like? Was it much different from senior club rugby, or was the jump big?
It would have been then, like, I mean, you know, when I played senior cup in school back in 2009 to what senior cup rugby is now,
yeah,
in school, it's night and day. Like, the lads kind of in modern day train more than professional teams actually do. Which is hard to believe, but like on feet, on pitch, they actually train more. Like the professional setup then, I suppose I would have went into the sub academy in Munster. And yeah, look, it's, you know, it's tough. It's a slog. It's not the kind of the pretty, I wouldn't call it glamorous lifestyle if you're in an academy or as a professional rugby athlete in Ireland anyway. But it's not all that it's cracked up to be, or what people think it's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, really early mornings, like that, going about your college day and coming back in for training in the evening time then. So, yeah, it's tough.
And Mr. Kavanagh, how did you find the jump from obviously playing as a younger player into playing with, playing with teams like Cork City? How did you find that? It was like jump.
I suppose I didn't really think about it too much. I kind of, the format, I suppose, has changed now, where underage now you have League of Ireland teams looking after the likes of under 14s, 15s, 17s and so on. But when I was there, you were with your club,
yeah,
so Leaside Knockra or Ringman, up until the age of kind of 16. And then that's when the under 19 Cork City setup kind of began, just as I was finishing kind of 16s. So I went straight from kind of Ringman, which was a really, really good setup. Kieran O'Reilly was kind of in charge there, and he had played League of Ireland previously. So he kind of knew what League of Ireland setup was like. So our training was kind of based around that, really.
Yeah.
And we had a really, really good team. So it was much the same. Like, it was just train two nights a week and play your game at the weekend. That's kind of how it was. So it was very similar to what I was used to at Ringman.
Yeah.
But now, I think it's kind of changed, and probably it's a lot more professional now.
Yeah.
And, whereas they might have gym sessions and stuff during the week, along with their pitch sessions.
Yeah, and what's it like, obviously, going from professional to semi-pro? Is there a big jump in kind of the way you train or the way your lifestyle changes?
Funnily enough, I suppose, as a professional, you actually probably have more time in your hands.
Yeah.
Because as a semi-pro, you can't really depend on that income to provide for yourself or your family. So being a semi-pro, you're essentially working another job.
Yeah.
So as you can imagine, you're working your 9 to 5 or whatever, 8 to 3, anything along those lines. And then that evening, more than likely, you're going training.
Mm.
So you need to manage your time very, very well. Whereas when you're playing professionally, you train in the morning. You're probably in for 9, on the pitch for 10, half 10. Finish at 12, have lunch, and you're in the gym from probably 1 till 2.
Yeah.
So then after 2 o'clock, you basically have the whole day to yourself. So you have a lot of time there to kind of do whatever you want, you know. That's probably the biggest difference, really. Semi-pro is training at night time. Other than that, you're probably training the same amount. Probably can't get as much gym sessions in as you would like, or as you would as a professional. But you'd still have your game then on every Friday.
And how did you manage to, so I know you were teaching me while you were playing hurling, how did you manage to be able to keep track of things so easily and so well and effectively?
I suppose you just have good people managing you. Just for example, John Caulfield at Cork City at the time, while I was doing my degree in UCC, he was very understanding, I suppose, and allowed me to have training off every now and then. Didn't happen an awful lot, but it did happen sometimes, and he was very understanding and very supportive of it. And then also on the college side, I suppose, you would, again, just very understanding people who were willing, I suppose, to kind of extend deadlines and stuff and help you out as much as they could. So really, I suppose, without those type of people, it's impossible, you know.
And what about you, Mr. Brown? I know you're coaching the senior rugby team this year and previous years beforehand. What's it like trying to be a teacher and coaching? And coaching is, obviously, it's basically professional and it's taking up loads of time. And I'd say you're thinking, it's just like playing, you know, you're thinking about it on and off the field. So what's it like trying to manage that?
Yeah, it's like, look, it's kind of, it's nice in one way. It's, I suppose it adds another aspect to school life for us. Like the way we'd interact with maybe the players, you know, you do have a different relationship to the lads that play rugby because you just know them better. You know, you spend so much time. I remember two years ago, I was saying to one of the lads, it was like we actually spend more time probably with them than we do our own families because of the amount of time we're in school, then out in the training field, doing analysis sessions, you know, in the gym. And by the time we go home, sure, I mean, it's only very, very few hours left before you're actually trying to get some downtime yourself. So, look, you just have to be very, very, I suppose, and this might be something Cav could allude to as well. You know, you do pick up a lot of skills along the way, being a professional, time management and being organised is one of them, certainly. Yeah. And I think that really feeds into certainly my life, anyway, at the moment, trying to, you know, navigate around prepping schoolwork, obviously being in the school day, prepping kind of training sessions, getting your analysis done and giving feedback to players. So, it's something I think takes organisation, takes planning. But it's something certainly that's very, very enjoyable anyway at the moment.
And did you always want to be a coach? I know you said you didn't really fall into love with the game of rugby until the 15, 16 years, but did you say, oh yeah, I'd like to coach here, or was it not until you came to the school? Or how did you originally get into it?
Well, it was actually when I was beginning to finish up professionally, it was actually Mr. Scott here in school touched base with me and asked me would I kind of help coach the Bone team. So that was my first real taste of coaching, and like I've changed drastically as a coach since then. But yeah, like look, coaching, it was something again that I never would have had planned to have done. Really, really enjoy coaching in school now. I've coached senior AIL clubs as well, but that's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
That's a completely different kettle of fish altogether. But I would say I enjoy coaching, but it's not something that I ever look to pursue professionally or anything, definitely not.
Mr. Kavanagh, throughout your years of playing soccer and playing GAA, do you think it's changed over your time of playing or over the decade?
Definitely. Suppose I'll just say GAA or hurling. At the beginning, I suppose, as a young kid, you kind of just went out and just played the game and didn't really care too much for tactics or systems of play or anything like that. But having gone back in the last kind of year and a half and stuff, I kind of realise now, I suppose, how important those things are to the game. And they've definitely progressed, obviously, since I last played 15 or so years ago. You'd probably expect that, I suppose, really. But you would see a bit of a shift, I suppose, in soccer as well in terms of systems of play, patterns of play and training and stuff. It's probably gone a lot more tactical. And that's just, I suppose, with exposure to various different leagues around the world.
Everyone's learning in a new game, yeah.
Yeah, and the coaching education system in Ireland with the FAI obviously has progressed as well throughout the last number of years. So Yeah, there's been a big change, I suppose, over the last few years, and I assume that'll continue to happen.
Mr. Bahan, also you touched on the trainings that the seniors do. You said they train even more than professional teams. Obviously, that's a big change for everyone. Is there much change in rugby through your time of playing?
Yeah, well, I don't think, like, in a professional sense, no. I think, like, I kind of would have entered into professional rugby maybe 14 years ago. And even at that time, it was very, there was a lot of, again, like John was saying, similar to soccer, a lot of kind of tactical awareness, analysis being done, different types of systems that teams around the world were playing, that kind of influence then maybe the Irish teams. But it's hugely changed in the, maybe the amateur levels. Like if you take like the senior All-Ireland League now in Ireland, it's basically semi-pro standard, the amount of training needed to be done, the amount of conditioning, the amount of analysis. When I came out of school, you know, you trained twice a week, played a game at the weekend, and that was it. You know, you barely went to the gym. There was no organised gym sessions. Mm. Whereas now, if you're not doing that, you're going to get injured in a heartbeat. And similar again, you know, I touched on earlier with my time playing senior cup rugby in school. Again, you know, well over 10 years ago, but it was, you know, very, very, I'm not going to say basic now because that would be disrespectful nearly, but yeah, like it was nowhere near what was being done in current day. Current day is literally like we're blessed here in this school to one of the kind of, I suppose, top providers of professional, ready-made professional athletes. You know, you see it like Ben O'Connor, Alex Kendall in the past few years, you know, within 6 months of them leaving school, they're making their Munster debut. So it's gone a bit crazy, if I'm being honest, like the amount of training that's being done. But I think that's just what it takes now, and that's what's the standard we've set.
Everyone's setting a new standard for themselves, and their game is really changing.
Exactly, yeah.
You are both young men, but why did you both decide to retire? Was there any reason, or was it hard to retire? Did you?
I suppose it just came to the end of last year, really, and I just felt I needed to do something fresh. I was a little bit annoyed, I suppose, really, with, annoyed is maybe the wrong word, but I suppose I was a little bit fed up, I suppose, really, of soccer.
Was there any reason for that, or is it just getting boring for you?
No particular reason, no, but as I said earlier, like, when you're playing with Cove, who would have been semi-pro, obviously I'm working in here every day, Monday to Friday, and you're hopping on a bus at 2 o'clock on a Friday evening to go to Dublin. And then you get back on the bus at 10 or 11 o'clock on a Friday night in Dublin. And you're not getting home till 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah, it's just hard to manage.
So I think that just kind of took its toll, really. Over the last kind of 2 or 3 years, that's kind of what I have been doing. And I just felt I needed something fresh. I played a small bit of hurling about 18 or so months ago. And I enjoyed it. Obviously, it's a lot closer play matches than going to Dublin for a match, for example. But and don't regret it, to be honest. Playing a small bit of soccer now at the moment with Middleton, obviously at a lesser level than Cove, which would be Munster Senior League. But the time commitments are actually similar, but it's a lot more flexible. That's my reasons for stepping back.
Is there any reason for you to retire, Mr. Bahan?
Yeah, mine was more kind of, I suppose, a life decision. You know, I was 25 at the time. I reflected really like on my position within the Munster squad, and was I ever going to progress onto, you know, ever getting to Irish standard? And I kind of think I was just honest with myself that I wasn't, you know. So I had to make a decision. Do you know, really keep involved in the provincial system in Irish rugby? You know, do I look for a club abroad and continue that lifestyle, which, like, don't get me wrong, like, is obviously you're making good money, you get to travel obviously a lot, and you're, you know, professional athlete, like, for a living. So but I had to kind of weigh up, like, I didn't have a degree at the time to drop out of college when I suppose got a professional contract. I needed to look at, like, look, what did I want to do with the rest of my life? because I knew, like, I always wanted to go into teaching. And I knew that's what I was going to do, and I knew it was going to be a 4-year degree that I was going to have to do to get there. So the longer I prolonged, or the longer I kind of put off going back to college, I knew that was going to eat into the rest of my life. Yeah. So yeah, I suppose like that was like the main decision around it. Like, was it going to be an Irish international? No. So yeah, just made the decision to kind of cut ties, make good connections with people in UCC. And was lucky enough to go back, get a place in a course there, played with UCC, and it was a nice transition between professional life then and getting back into what I'd call the real world. Because by playing kind of amateur level with UCC, which was still quite high in terms of standard, it was, you know, it still gave me that rugby fix. Yeah. But I was able to like that kind of start the rest of my life then at that age, rather than, you know, going on until I was 30 and then 34 by the time I was qualified. So yeah, a lot of decisions to kind of weigh up, you know, but that was the main thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it mustn't have been a regret for you, but I'm sure it must have been hard to leave that all behind and move on.
Yeah, especially kind of like friends, you know, or again, like I was saying, like it's the lifestyle, you know, you're in something very unreal or maybe surreal.
Yeah.
You know, like John was saying, your day's kind of finished at 2. Obviously you've recovery stuff in the evening times or, but like there are a lot of positives to that lifestyle as well. You're not just doing 9 to 5 like everybody else. But yeah, like I put it this way, like I haven't regretted walking away from professional sport once. It's never crossed my mind. And I think when that's the case, you know, it was the right decision for you.
Mr. Bahan said that he always had a passion for teaching. Did you also have that, Mr. Kavanagh?
I suppose when I look back, really, there's teachers that would have taught me, I suppose, in secondary school, and you kind of look up to them. And looking back now, I think they had a big influence on me. And I'd nearly kind of say it was people like that that kind of gave me the grout to go do something like that. And my sister is a teacher as well. So yeah, like it's kind of one of those things, didn't really give a whole lot of thought to it. Just kind of went with it and things just kind of fell into place really. And I'm really enjoying it. Glad it took the opportunity to do it, yeah.
Yeah.
And a bit more of a kind of question that everyone kind of wants to know. I know we have a bit of a crowd here. Who was the toughest player you ever played against, Mr. Wan?
The toughest player I ever played against.
Or it could be with as well, or just the best player. With or against.
Or any standout kind of players.
I remember I actually played against Cardiff in Musgrave Park, and Sam Warburton was, it would have been like, did he captain the Lions on one of the tours, I'm pretty sure. But I remember, yeah, being in a ruck and him hitting me in that ruck, and it was as if my entire body rattled. But I'd say he was proper, like he was tough as nails, to be fair to him. Jonathan Davies as well, another Welsh player, he'd have been quite a tough character, like, you know. Sure, he's still playing to this day. But yeah, I'd say the two of them would have been the toughest players that I would have ever come across, like, on the pitch.
And what about you, Mr. Kavanagh?
Probably Yanezi. We went over with Cork City in the 19s to play Man United. It was around January time, just after Christmas. And Yanezi was playing with them. And he just kind of just moved differently. To be honest, he was unbelievable. Nobody could get near him. Probably one of the best players I played with then would have been Shawnee Maguire. He was very good, and obviously when he came to Cork City he was exceptional. In the league then, Michael Duffy was probably the trickiest opponent. He would play with Dundalk and Derry now at the moment. So.
And another question for the listeners, what advice would you give to, you know, a young person that wants to follow in your footsteps and become a professional athlete?
Think twice about it. And make sure it's, I'd say make sure it is something that you know you're going to have to sacrifice your whole life to actually be successful in. Mm. And like professional lifestyle for some people is absolutely amazing. It is all that they expected it to be and they love doing it. But like there is the realization with and the reality with professional sports that like you sacrifice everything. You sacrifice, you know, the decisions of your wife, you know, everyone in your family, because your timetable dictates when you go on holidays, when you can do this, that, or the other. You like, you know, socially, you don't get to go to all the events that all your friends are going to. So yeah, I definitely say think twice about it, but I would also say in an equal vein, if you know it's 1,000,000% what you want to do, then go for it. You know, don't listen to people telling you to not do it. You know, if it's something you really, really want to do and go after, then like go after it. But like make sure it's 100%, because if it's not, you won't be successful.
And what about you, Miscavige?
Well, I suppose realistically, loads of people will tell you this, but you lose more times than you win.
Mm.
There's a lot more downs than there is ups. But I think if you have a chance, go for it. Or if you think there's a chance that you can play professionally or at a very, very high level, I think you have to go for it.
Yeah.
But as Mr. Bohan said, sacrifices to get to that level, only you will realise once you're kind of involved in that. But I suppose just from my point of view, like what I've seen over the last maybe 6-7 months when I kind of took a step back from soccer, is the nights out, really, things like that, maybe family events, obviously they're tough to miss, but in terms of socializing and stuff, I'm nearly delighted now when I have a match and I can't go to something, you know.
It's our age now, though.
Probably, yeah. Showing our age here, yeah, I suppose, more so. But as I said, no, like there's a lot more downs than there is ups. But if you have a chance and if that's what you want to do, just go for it. Give it everything.
And Mr. Bohan, do you have a favourite sporting memory from your career?
I'd say my Munster debut. We're playing Zebre over in Italy, and I just think, you know, it's something that you've worked so hard towards. And it is, you know, again, obviously people have different pinnacles in their professional life or in their sporting lives. I would say that one, and I would say my final ever game for Munster was actually, I was captain of the British and Irish Cup team, and we ended up winning the British and Irish Cup, and that was kind of my bow out. Like, so, you know, it was going out on a high, but also, you know, your first cap is always going to be something special.
And what about you, Miss Kelly?
I suppose as a moment, I suppose under 19, I captained Cork City to a double, which was a league and a cup double. That was quite special. But while playing senior then, I think it's not really a moment, but it's just kind of every Friday going to Turner's Cross and just stepping out in front of 4,000 and 5,000 and 6,000. At the time, you kind of take for granted. But when you look back, that's kind of what you enjoy,
yeah.
You know? So I suppose those two things kind of stick out for me.
Thank you for that, both of you. We really enjoyed this interview. Thanks for coming on, and we hope to have you on maybe again.
All right, thanks, guys. Awesome.
Thanks very much.
Wow, that was a fascinating interview, Matthew. How does it feel to have the first big one in the bag?
I'm feeling great, Stephen, although I have to admit I didn't have the time to get nervous as I was called up last minute. Kudos to Aidan, though, who did all the research and questions and was due to take the hot seat with Harry, but was out on the day we recorded. It was great, though, to explore two sports I really love and to do with some ex-pros who teach here in our school in front of a live studio audience of third years. All quite surreal.
It must be indeed, Matthew. And a big thanks once again to Mr. Kavanagh and Mr. Bohan for giving us so much of their time.
Absolutely, Stephen. Now the show must go on. What do we have next?
Well, we are sticking with sport for a while, Matthew. I spoke to our fellow podcaster and TY student here in Prez, Jacob Dars, about his recent conversion to mixed martial arts and his journey to becoming an Irish champion and how the sport has changed his life. We've all heard of Conor McGregor and the cage. But did you know that we have our very own 3-time National MMA League gold medalist here in Prez? I'm very pleased to welcome my fellow fourth year, Jacob Dars, onto the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
Thank you for coming. So, Jacob, MMA, I never see this sport around. I rarely come across it. What got you into MMA?
Well, there's a local gym near my house, and one evening my mom just decided to bring me down and see if I'd like it, because I was kind of having trouble finding something to do. So I was spending a lot of time around the house. I wasn't playing sport, like, because I kind of dropped the rugby, and I wasn't playing with the Glen no more. And I just went in there, and it was like a light switch, like, do you know what I mean? I started and I never stopped.
That's nice. So instant kind of love for the sport.
Yeah. It took some time, you know. It was a few weeks. I didn't want to go down, but once I started training proper and so that improvement started coming, so when I started besting lads I wasn't before besting, that kind of motivated me to keep training and become one of the best.
That's a very, very good mindset. So where do you train?
I train down in MMA Cork. It's located in Blackpool.
Okay.
It's kind of the industrial centre.
And how many times would you train now a week?
6 days a week.
Was it always 6 days, or was
no,
it?
No, never. It was only this year I really started. It was January of the year prior is when I started. But I was only going down twice a week, you know. And it wasn't until kind of that September I kind of come down a bit more. I knew there was going to be fights coming up, and it was March of this year. That's when it kind of just snapped in me, and I was down there 6 days a week, like every day. Because it's so close to my house, I can just cycle down. And having my first fight like that just motivated me even more to train.
When was your first fight?
It was March of this year.
And did you win?
I did, yes. I fought twice that day and I won both.
Very well done. Your parents, you said your mum drove you down.
She did, yeah.
So have your parents been overall very, very supportive of your choice of pursuing MMA?
My parents are my biggest supporter. They've helped me more than anybody else. You know, like, of course, my mum, obviously, she worries for me, like, but my dad thinks it's the best thing that ever happened to me, this training. Do you know what I mean? He says he sees a change in me. Do you know, my demeanor, my motivation, my attitude towards things. And just unreal
mentally,
support.
The impact has really improved.
Mentally,
your life.
I think I've changed a lot. You know what I mean? Knowing that, like, you are not invincible, but you know you can handle yourself. Like, do you know what I mean? It changes something in your head.
That's very, very honest. So you just mentioned there, you train 6 days a week. And that's very, very full on, and I'm assuming time consuming.
Yeah.
So how do you juggle, you know, social life and all other aspects of life, really, and then your training, so you're still down at the gym 6 times a week?
Well, my social life is at the gym, you know what I mean? That's where my friends are. Like, I enjoy my time there just as much as I enjoy training. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can have fun down there. Do you know what I mean? It's not just strict, you know? But It's fine with school. Like, I find time. Like, I training now, it's 6 o'clock Monday to Friday, and then 12 o'clock then on a Saturday. And it just works out well for me, you know. It takes me 20 minutes to get down, 25 minutes to get back. And, like, I'll be home for 8 o'clock, like, time for school.
Okay, well, sounds like you have it balanced out quite well. So, training. Talk to me about your training. What do you do? What is your schedule? What is planned each day, Monday, Tuesday, through to
Well, there's a clash regiment that's put out. So on Monday now, 6 o'clock to 7:30 is jiu-jitsu. On a day like today now, it's striking and wrestling. On a Wednesday then, it's wrestling. Do you know what I mean? That's how they structure the week. So you're kind of a well-rounded fighter.
And do you have a favourite day?
I do, yeah. Monday jiu-jitsu is by far my favourite.
Is that what you would class yourself to be best at?
I would consider myself very talented at jiu-jitsu.
Very well put. So you spoke of a fight you had in March where you won.
Yes.
Have you had any other fights since?
Multiple, yeah. I had another MMA leagues in June, and I fought 3 times that day, and I won all 3 by first round submission, which kind of got me a bit noticed. And you know, the opportunity came up then, and I was able to fight on Cage Legacy, which, those who don't know, is a very big amateur promotion in Ireland. And I got the lucky opportunity to fight on the prelims of that card and against a very, very tough opponent, Alex Flanagan. He actually beat me. He flying triangled me in the first round, and it was my first defeat ever. And, you know, there's nothing quite like a loss. You know, people think they'll understand that feeling, but they don't. You know, I saw my parents in the crowd, and obviously, of course, the hundreds of people there. And losing in front of them was something, you know, was hard to take. But only 2 weeks ago, I had another MMA leagues. And I fought twice, and I won both my fights. And it was a huge, huge comeback for me, mentally. And one opponent, Waldo from France. He was very, very tough, but I ended up getting the decision victory. And now, December 16th, not only am I booked for Cage Legacy again, on December 3rd, I have another MMA league to look forward to. So there will be many fights soon.
Very packed Christmas, so with fights.
Very.
I wish you the best of luck for them.
Thank you, Stephen.
So just back to what you said about the submission. For those who would not know what a submission is, could you give us a little brief explanation?
Well, there's three ways to win a fight. There's obviously your decision when the judges favour you. There's a submission when you make your opponent tap, be this to a choke, a submission hold, or just them wanting out. And the final way to win is a knockout, which is obviously very, very brutal. I've no knockouts in my career, as the teen rules are very strict. But those are the three methods of victory.
Okay. And how long would a fight usually last had it gone to a decision?
One four-minute round is scheduled for a person of my age.
From my understanding, very little knowledge, there's different weight classes. Could you go into a little bit more detail on that?
Yes, there is. Well, I'm on the smaller side of things, so I fight a flyweight, which is 57 kilo. This is very easy for me to make, as I walk around at kind of 55, 56. However, I've also fought at bantamweight, which is 61 kilograms. I fought at bantamweight in my last MMA leagues, and I weighed in at, I think it was 58 that day.
And you said you have the Cage Legacy coming up.
Yes.
Do you know who you will be fighting then?
Yeah, his name is Ronan Bradley. He is a kickboxer. You know, I don't know if he has much full MMA experience. However, he will still be treated like every other opponent. You know, he will be tough, and I'm hoping to come away to victory this time.
I hope you do. Incredibly, Jacob, for those listeners interested in watching you, they actually can via pay-per-view. Could you give us a little bit more about that?
Yes, my fight on December 16th will be live on pay-per-view. This can be bought through the Cage Legacy Instagram, or there'll be a link in my bio when that's released.
So, thank you very much, Jacob, for coming on air today. I wish you the best of luck in your fight, and I hope that after Christmas I can welcome you back as a champion.
Thanks very much for having me, Stephen.
Well, we wish Jacob well in his fight and in his future career. And with that, we segue from the future to the past. This next segment is particularly interesting, Stephen, isn't it?
It is for sure, Matthew. Eamon McCarthy, born and bred on the Grand Parade right in the heart of our city, and now in his 92nd year, came into Prez to talk to his grandnephew, Emmett Brady, about growing up in Cork during the 1930s and also about wartime Cork. Back in time we go, take it away.
Today we have a very special guest with us today, someone who is coming up on almost a century living in Cork. At 91 years of age, Eamon McCarthy has seen the city transform over 9 decades. He has lived through several world events, including World War II, the swinging 60s, epidemics, pandemics, the creation of TV and smartphones of today. We have a lot to talk about, Eamon. Why don't we, seeing as it's a Christmas episode, why don't we start off? What was Christmas like for you as a boy?
Well, Christmas on the Grand Parade was a bit mixed, because my mother was from Kilfinan, County Limerick, and she had to go up and down and look after her father. So I spent some time in the Grand Parade and some time in Kilfinan. And one memory I have of Kilfinan, which occurred to me only a few days ago, my father brought down a pair of boxing gloves, just one pair. I got very handy with one hand. The other one have to be given to your opponent, and a big compendium of games, Ludo, chess, everything. And the young lad I was playing with across the road, he got an orange. That was his Christmas present. And it's difficult for children and young people today to accept that. He got an orange for Christmas. And if I can divert myself a moment, during the war, I remember when the first consignment of oranges and bananas came into Cork, around maybe 45, 44. And people came from all over the city. The city wasn't so big then, but they came from all over the city to buy. They didn't care whether they were green or mouldy, but to buy the oranges. But Kilfinan was quite good. It was around the start of the war in 1939. And I remember, this has nothing to do with Christmas, but I remember when we were playing games out in the street, not cowboys and Indians, but war. All of us wanted to be Germans. And only the very few brave young fellows decided to be English soldiers. And that'll give an indication of what the political climate was around at the time. And when the news would come on at 6 o'clock, we were fortunate in Kilvenna, we had one of the two radios in the town. And you'd get the news at 6 o'clock, and it'd be a report that the Messerschmitts had shot down so many Spitfires and so many English planes, and we'd be cheering. Just showed, in a sense, how brainwashed we were by the Republican movement in Ireland. And my uncle was in the IRA, Donald Limerick, and my mother, Lord of Melstein, was a rabid Republican. And it shows how brainwashed we were, that didn't care who was killed in the raids and all that. So it probably put a damper on Christmas. And then we came back up to Cork when my grandfather died, about 41. And Christmas Cork was a different ball game entirely, on the Grand Parade entirely. And the excitement and the entertainment was the movies. Myers, you've never heard of Myers. Myers was the Imperial down opposite Keane's Jewelers in Oliver Plunkett Street. It was called Lourdes at the time because they said you go in infirm and you go in healthy and you come walking with fleas. And then the assembly rooms at the Coliseum, there were a lot of cinemas around there, and Christmas was trying to get into a movie on Stephen's Day. And particularly when you were a bit flush with money, when I say flush with money, you might have 2 shillings. And that would bring you to 2 or 3 movies. And my father, Lord of Melstein, he worked that time in an auctioneer's, one of the leading auctioneers in the city, and one of his clients was Alec Day in Patrick Street. Now, Day's were a toy shop, and near where Dunstores opened their first shop. And their window was a pleasure to look at. We always had the railway sets and everything moving up there. And at Christmas, Robert or Alec, the son, but he'd always give a bunch of toys to my father. So we always had card games and toys in the house on Christmas Day. And we had people, lodgers above us, and they had young kids as well. So my father would always detract some of the ones from us and give them to them, and we resented it very much. But it was Christmas in Cork. What was also very attractive to us, and very few people seem to be aware of this now, even in my age group. First of all, you had ships coming in down the quay, and every one of the ships had a barrage balloon affixed to it. And they were supposed to deter particularly fighter planes from coming in to attack the ship because they were liable to get fouled in the cables. The cars at that time, what cars were running, had big gas balloons up on top of them. Now, from the mechanical side, I don't know how the hell they worked, but they were able to pump gas into them. And that was, but the most attractive feature at the time was air raid shelters. Now, have you ever heard of air raid shelters in the city? They were big concrete. They were about the size of a single-decker bus. There were 8 in the Grand Parade, one directly behind the monument by the river. There were 3 down the middle of the street as far as the fountain, and there might have been another 3 or 4 down as far as the Singer's Corner. And they were a great source of attraction to us too, climbing them. And now, strange enough, we never got into one until they were nearly knocked, until about 4 years later somebody opened the door. And we lost all interest because they were only a concrete box. But they were very handy at climbing at times. And what was particularly handy about them in the Grand Parade, right opposite where O'Shea's Bakery was, which became after the Grand Parade nightclub and the Grand Parade Hotel, there was a gap between two of them. And that was a goal. And the other goal was the lane next to, Kiff's Lane next to O'Shea's.
Sorry not to interrupt you. When they were finally taken down, when they were destroyed.
About 46.
Did that kind of create a lot of hope within the general people? Or did it kind of like, was it a kind of sign that war was...
No, I don't think so. I think that the war, in a sense, nearly passed us by, except for rationing. And a lot of the fathers and uncles were in England. Mm-hmm. If they weren't in the army or the marine or the sea and the navy, they were in factories.
How would rationing have affected your Christmases, would you say?
Rationing was a bit of a curse. You got a ration book, butter, tea, sugar. They were all rationed until towards the end of the war, bread became rationed. And we sort of managed, all right. My mother, I've made a great effort for her. I decided to give up butter and sugar. And I felt like, honest to God, like I felt like a saint. I was so good. And not knowing that my brother, who was 2 years older than me, got all the benefit of it because he was never denied anything. And as he was eating them. And strange enough, when I met my wife now, she was in the very same position. For the duration of the war, she gave up them, and her brother, who was five years older, he had the benefit. But towards the end of the war, bread became rationed, and only that the war finished fairly quickly then, we'd have been starving because we couldn't cope with the bread rationed. Bread was, that time, it was a basic standard diet, and we were near the market as well, and you got certain... The meat was never rationed, strange enough. And I remember a scene one time towards the end of the war when the English minesweepers came into Cork Harbour, and they came round in droves shopping in, and you'd see five or six of them together clustered outside a butcher shop. O'Flynn's was one particular one in Oliver Procursey, and they all debating, would they go in or wouldn't. And then one fellow would be selected to go in and say, is there any chance we could buy some meat? And he answered the invalid, how much money have you? And they sent the parcels of meat away. They didn't know what meat was. No, like that, as well as the rationing, as well as the shortage, there was also a question of money. Money was very tight, always. And so we did reasonably well. Our house in the Grand Parade was a big house, and my mother was able to let out some of the rooms above it. So we were nearly the first tenement, only not quite a tenement. There was a tenement near us in 55 Grand Parade, and I was regularly being warned not to go up there playing. And of course, the more you were warned, my mother being a country woman, she had a fine degree of snobbery, and because they had their own house and ours was their own house, and we were up there. There was one particular family up there, a young woman with a couple of young kids. This was very amusing to us. A nice woman, very chatty and all. And he discovered a couple of years after she was in the game. So I won't explain that to you, I'll have to assume you know what I'm talking about. But I remember going up to that house to call for a friend, and most of the banisters had disappeared. And eventually the strings of the upright bit of the stairs, they were disappearing. Because you must remember, the heating and sometimes the cooking in these rooms was the fireplace. And somebody would sneak over the night and break off a bit of banister and put it. You were liable to fall down the stairs if you went up there. And that fire was a lifeline for most people, including ourselves. And at the time you would get coal and turf, but the turf you would get was pure sodden. And you would have to... Invariably, mother would get a sheet of Dieco and put it in front of the fireplace to draft the fire. No, none of you probably ever saw that happening, but it does create a draft in the chimney. And Christmas like that was for most people, most of the lads I'd be playing with, was probably the orange and the apple, if they were available. And during the war, they weren't. And I remember one of the families, and there was a lane, and Kiff's Lane was actually what they'd regard in Dublin as a slum. There were houses up there, maybe half dozen houses, and there could be five or six families living in them, in three stories. And I'd be calling up for the lads to go to the movies or something. That time they said, You could, remember, you could go to the movie if you collected jam jars and you bring them in and you'll get twopence or a penny or mm. you get the price of the movies from. Everything was used. And up there, they were fairly severe. One toilet out the back and four or five families in it. And I went in one particular family, other than two lads, and my fellas sitting up on the double bed and they having their dinner. And they did on the various mashed potatoes and a couple of onions this morning. But between that and the area shelters, I'm sort of amazed there wasn't more made of the history of the area shelters, because when they were being knocked down, I think it would be around 46, 47, there was a bulldozer going on with a one-ton big steel ball, and they'd swing that at the area shelter and eventually knock it to the ground. And that was better than any movie, to follow the bulldozer around town and see them knocking them. Then occasionally we had fires. We had one great fire that I got great entertainment over, where Grant's Fire on the Grand Parade, where the cameo was after that, and now is not Harvey Norman, TK Maxx facing mm-hmm. Washington Street. And I saw that from the very start. I started hours. I saw the fire brigade coming on. I could see the in the window, what I thought was like silk curtains. And eventually the fire brigade came round and chap got up on a single ladder up as far as the lettering and pulled up a hose for them and took out the hatchet and broke the glass. And pulled up the hose and there was a dribble came out of it. And the flame shot out and he had to jump onto the next letter and be rescued. And we had great fun that time because they were drawing the water from the river and the horses were all going up to Grand Parade, and because it was wartime, they were leaking all over the place. So we could find a wee ways of manoeuvring the leak from one side of the area shelter to the other, wait for people to walk up the other side and twist the hose around. And that was... that was the Grand Parade, and that was the boss of the fire brigade was fired. And it was a bit unfortunate because he had a combination of wartime shortages and the river was never lower, and the Lee River was never lower, so there was no water. And there was a certain amount of negligence because we saw that building burn and the windows full of clothes and shoes and everything. And at one stage, I thought the crowd were going to rush at it to do a bit of looting, because to see all the stuff, it was incredible.
So just because you mentioned the hose, what were the other ways you guys would kind of keep yourselves entertained?
Well, we had a football, as I said. The football mm-hmm. consisted of, you first of all got one fella in the gang who was a brilliant at tying a paper ball, mm-hmm. because all you had were paper, wrap them up tightly with, and they might last the duration of a match. But particularly on a Sunday, now we might be going from across, any bit of traffic they came, we'd have to wait. Well, remember the ball was crossing the street. And if you had a hurley, the nearest bit of green field to us was Monaghan Road, Buggy Road, as we call it at the time. And that became a semi-jump after the, we'd have to go down there and have a bit of kick around and probably invariably have a fight with whatever local gang was there or something. I'll go up to the lock. And that was a long distance we'd be walking up to the lock. And it was many years after before we got bikes and all that. But we'd actually go down there and with somebody with a box car, we'd go down to Buggy Road and set fire to something in the dump.
So what's your fondest memory of Christmas? What do you remember of it? It would have been a lot more religious back then.
There'd be more religious. You had to go to the St. Augustine's was our nearest church. And everyone actually, it was very rarely that you'd get, you were talking about far right, no wonder what you call it, an unbeliever. It was very rarely you'd get someone who didn't, they might go to, if they didn't go to Mass, they'd go to Christmas and devotions and all that. But I remember another sign of the economic times at the time, Sunday night, my relations, uncles, they'd come down to our kitchen and they'd be playing 110 or 45 or something. And I remember we'd be sitting on a couch playing pantones. And I remember the topic of conversation one night, they were all outraged because St. Augustine's had a bit of a sign up at the table, "Twopence, please." That was "Twopence, please." And I can see out at Mass and Talk, we go to Talk and Mass and a lot of people won't even put twopence into the bin. But it was regarded as outrageous at that time to ask for the specific amount. But otherwise, Christmas, like everything else, you went by, you got your presents and you played with them. And I got a hurley 1 year, and of course, about 2 weeks into it, some fellow borrowed it off me and broke it against the stone, like it hit a stone instead of a ball. And so the main lead. Now we a little bit of different one at times too as well. And then you had local characters around the place coming in. You'd be having fun with them too as well. Probably racist, no, some of the. And then you had elections regularly then too as well. I remember De Valera and all them. And I wasn't old enough for Michael Collins, but at the same time there was only about 10 years between him and the Civil War and all before I was born. So but Christmas was always, and the major problem was, the major interest was going on looking at the shops, knowing that you couldn't afford them. And as I say, Day's shop in the Grand in the Patrick's, it was a good, lovely shop, a small shop, but a lovely shop to look at.
I will, Eamon, I've kept you here for much longer, but don't thank you so much for that interview. That was amazing. It was lovely talking
to you. I leave it up to the audience to separate the lies from the truth. Because there's always an exaggeration, hyperbole. So not at all.
Well, thank you very much. That was lovely.
And you're very welcome back to PBC Podcast. A remarkable interview there, Stephen. Eamon McCarthy, age 91. What an incredible man. Our thanks to Eamon for making the journey down here to Prez and enriching us with those memories. So onwards and upwards, Stephen. What's next?
Well, Matthew, by now I'm sure you've noticed the yellow jackets on the streets as you walk through town. And what is Christmas if not a time of giving? Our next segment informs us how we as students and individuals can help make people's lives all the better by giving up our time and money. Ben Collin was joined in studio just before Yellow Day by student chairman of Share, Andrew Malm, and a voice you may recognise from previous seasons of PBC Podcast, Brian O'Leary. Take it away, Ben.
Hello there and welcome to the PBC Podcast. My name is Ben Collin and today I'm joined by our special guest here today, Andrew Malm, chairman of the Share Student Executive, and Brian O'Leary, head of marketing and PR. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having us on.
No doubt many of our listeners are familiar with the work of Share, but can you give us a quick refresh of our memory, please, Andrew?
So Share is a charity set up in Cork. It was set up in 1970 by the students of Prez. It stands for Students Harness Aid for the Relief of the Elderly. It is normally a committee of fourth and fifth year students, such as myself and Brian. There's about 20 other Prez lads in the school on the committee. Prez has been involved in Share for 54 years strong. Prez has the strongest links with Share. So that's why we need to keep it tight every year, make sure there's enough Prez people on the committee. And also we need involvement from other schools. So we have 14 schools on the committee this year. There's Sculvora, Mount Mercy, Regina Mundi, Claustacullum, Christree, many schools in Cork. And we need to keep those ties strong, really. And we need to keep the relationships good. So Share helps that hugely.
Thanks a lot for that, Andrew. What made you personally decide to join Share?
Well, it was really my brother and my dad. So my dad was a member of the committee, geez, I don't know, 1980, 84 maybe.
Some time back when the dinosaurs were
still around. Yeah. And my brother was on the committee 3 years ago. He's in college in first year now. And my brother said to me during the summer, I was sitting down watching Netflix inside the front room and he came in to me and he was asking me if Cher had been mentioned to us yet. And I said, no, not yet. And he came in and he said, Andrew, you'd be a great fit for chairman, so you might as well go for it. So that's what I decided to do. And just hearing the stories from over the years from my brother and my dad, they said Cher was the best experience they had inside in Prez. They were both two Prez boys, same as myself. They said Cher was the best experience they had. It really made them think about the world in a better view, and it kind of helps them grow as a person. So that's really why I wanted to join, just from hearing the good stories and trying to help people is what I want to do.
How about you, Brian?
Yeah, I suppose I'm the same as Andrew. I suppose we went out collecting last year and we were on the streets kind of in the cold and the rain collecting. And I think I was kind of interested to know more about what the charity was doing. And obviously I knew some of the history of Share going into it, but I was talking to committee members last year and they said it was a great experience for them and that they enjoyed it a lot. So I put myself forward for it. And it's been probably one of the best decisions I've made experience-wise, you know. So, yeah.
What do you feel is unique about Share, and what do you think sets it apart from other charities?
Well, I suppose what's unique about Share is that it's 50 new teenagers coming in every year, and you only get a year, I suppose, then. And no other charities really like that, where you have a kind of almost kind of like a wheel going of different students in every year and out and in and out. And that's very unique because you have basically a year to build the chemistry, to do everything you can do in order to achieve what you want to achieve. I suppose also what's very important about Share is probably the intergenerational link between us as, you know, kind of young adults, teenagers, and the elderly people that we're dealing with in Share.
I was just talking to my family about this as well. My mum always says to me, Cork is Share, Share is Cork, every year at Christmas for the last 54 years. There has been people from Share in Cork collecting for 9 days, 10 days. If you ever go into town at Christmas, you know Share. Share is a unique charity because it's always there. It will always be there.
It's clear that Share is very personal towards you, Andrew. What does being the chairman of it mean to you, Andrew?
It means a lot because it is a big responsibility, but I am perfectly willing and able to cope with that responsibility. I know myself, I feel I'm a hardworking individual and I know how much effort I can put into this. And Share will be probably the best thing I do inside Imprez because you get the most out of it. It's a good thing to build relationships with your fellow students and students from other schools. Yeah, it does mean a lot to me. I know it's a big task to be chairman, and some people might hate me at the end of it. Some people might like me at the end of it. I might push people too hard. I might not push people enough. But as long as I try my best, and I will try my best, I know I'll do a good job.
Do you think that your involvement in Share will have an influence on the rest of your life?
Definitely. I mean, as I said, my brother and my dad were a part of Share, and they said doing Share made them grow individually, and that will be the same for me, I have no doubt. We've only been at Share for 2 months now, and I already feel twice as responsible as I did before we started. I feel like my public speaking has come along. I feel like my ability to have a conversation with anyone has come along. So it will help me, hugely.
What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, obviously we're only maybe 1 or 2 months into it, but I think even in those 2 months, it's been nice to be part of a team, I suppose, and you're kind of building new connections with people you've never met in your life before. And you've got to work together with strangers almost to achieve a common goal, which can be difficult at times, but it's also very rewarding when it goes well. So I'd like to think that it's probably going to be a very good experience for myself and Andrew and all the committee members. And I'm just very looking forward, really, to driving on with the rest of the year and getting to work.
Talk to me about Yellow Day.
So Yellow Day is a day in usually late November, and we ask students to wear yellow into school, and we ask for a donation of €2 maybe. But this year on Yellow Day, myself, Andrew, and a few other people on the executive committee, we kind of want to put more of an emphasis on kind of the message that we're trying to get across and kind of not just putting €2 into a cup for the sake of putting €2 into a cup. We want to really get across our message, and it's to share and to show you care. So we're asking people this year, if they're donating to Share, to also try to spend time with someone elderly in your life and kind of show you care, I suppose. That's the saying goes. So that's really, Yellow Day this year is going to be very big for us, and we're all systems going out at the moment building up for it.
Like what Yellow Day does is it builds more of a relationship between the secondary school students of Cork with the committee and with Share, because normally if you're in town and you're asking someone to donate, it would be an adult. You wouldn't go up to a student from secondary school in a secondary school uniform and ask them to donate, because chances are they won't have money on them. So that's really what Yellow Day does. It gets the students of Cork more involved. And just from being here in Prez, we started giving talks and PowerPoint presentations to the first to third years and soon the fourth years, just to, because when we were in first year, we were in second year, we didn't know what chair was. If you asked me in third year, I probably might not have known what chair was. I would have come in on yellow day, I would have given you €2, but I wouldn't know the message behind chair. So that's really what we want to emphasize this year, what we want to put importance on, is getting in touch with an elderly person in your area, be that a grandparent, be that a neighbor, anyone. Just try and spend time with them, have a conversation with them, run an errand for them. Just try and put some emphasis on that. Try and complete our message this year if you're taking part in Yellow Day or donating to share.
So Brian, tell me a bit about some upcoming collections.
It's all duty go for us then, I think, for the next till Christmas Eve, till the 24th of December. So I suppose myself and Andrew are just asking everyone who's asked this year to come out and collect, no matter what school you are, like 4th years, 5th years, we're just really asking them to come out and to collect, no matter if it's raining, like as much as you can possibly come out and help us. It's massively appreciated. You've no idea. And it is a great experience. Like, bad and all as it might sound in your head standing in the rain for 5 hours, you have fun. Like, you're having chats with your friends. You're doing something good for your community. And I think there should be no reason really why you don't come out. And it just is, it's a great experience for yourself. And I think even if you are interested in being on a committee next year, you should get out there and you should collect for chair. Such a good charity.
That's all true, Brian. I mean, collections last year was probably the highlight of 4th year, one of the highlights.
I think so, definitely.
It put us to the test really, because we were out 5 days a week.
But we had fun as well.
Like, we did have fun.
There was great memories made, and there's great memories to be made. And I think it's so important as a 4th year, if you have the time to come out and to help us out and to donate, it's a great experience for yourself. You learn much, and you learn so much actually about yourself, which you wouldn't think just standing there, but you will learn hard work and standing there and just talking to people. And it's just a great experience. So I'd recommend and encourage everyone who can come out to help us to please do.
And it does help you mature as well. I mean, like, I'm only 17, 3 weeks, and I already feel like I could run the world, like, with the help of my family, my friends, and everyone.
And
Brian, of course. But that's kind of all stemmed from collections last year. Being out there 5 days for the week, that kind of showed me how much work we need to put in life and how much you will get out if you put in that work. And that was really all thanks to the collections of my family and friends.
All right, thanks a lot, guys. It's been really educational to listen to you both. I would ask all of our listeners to try and maybe heed some of your advice, and have a good one.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Welcome back. You're listening to PBC Podcast Season 4, Episode 1. And that was a timely reminder of just how wonderful a charity share is and how proud we are in Prez over the contribution we make. So please dig deep when you see the students out there on the streets in their yellow jackets this Christmas.
Lovely to hear former host of the podcast, Brian O'Leary, back behind the mic again too, Matthew. He's a hard act to follow.
He surely is, Stephen, but I think we're doing okay so far. But come on, let's keep the show tickling over while it's going good. What's up next?
Well, we are sticking with Christmas theme and have a real treat coming up. We haven't had radio drama featured on the podcast for a while, and when Mr. Olinchik asked Tadhg O'Connor, 5th year, to script something for this episode, he didn't disappoint. Here is Tadhg using his incredible repertoire of voices. He is joined by 5th year Rona McCarthy, who voices the Ghost of Christmas Present and Tiny Tim. The drama also features Casper Scully of 1st year no less as the Ghost of Christmas Past in an adapted script of a seasonal favourite.
Humbug indeed, Stephen. Let's hear now from Ebenezer Scrooge in Tadhg's quirky take on Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Enjoy.
No, Molly, leave me be. Molly, no. Huh? Ah, what in heaven? A ghost! At the end of my bed! Who are you, boy?
Hi, Mr. Scrooge! I'm the Ghost of Christmas Past! Golly gosh, are you going to have a busy night tonight? All that stuff Mr. Marley told you! Gee, it was all true!
Bah! Humbug! I don't care what that whingebag has to say! I'm entitled to my earnings! The world has enough charity workers!
Hey now, no need to be grumpy!
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I have a right to be upset about being woken up at this ungodly hour.
All right, all right. We need to get to the bottom of why you hate Christmas. Any ideas, Mr. Scrooge? No? That's fine. We'll find out together.
I'd rather not.
Here we go, Mr. Scrooge!
What the dickens? Is that... Belle? Oh, no.
Ah, Mr. Scrooge, you and your girlfriend look so cute together. You're so cheesy.
Yes, it was a great time in my life. I was an apprentice. The leaving cert was finished, and I had Belle. Could we stay here a while? I'd love to remember what this was like.
Nah, sorry, Mr. Scrooge. We have a schedule to keep to. Also, this doesn't explain why you hate Christmas. You seem to be having the time of your life.
Bah, I'm going to call the police.
Here we go, Mr. Scrooge.
Oh, my Lord above in heaven. But she doesn't know who I am. And she doesn't give a damn.
Wait. Oh, my God. Is that you? Playing guitar outside Belle's window. Oh, God. That's so sad.
This is why I despise children.
I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag baby.
That is sad. All right, all right. I'll take you back to your apartment now.
Finally.
All right. I see that your past was really, really, really... pathetic? No, too mean. Unfortunate? Yes, unfortunate. But you can't let one little breakup ruin Christmas for you.
Bah, bloody humbug. You just reminded me why Christmas is the worst time of the year. And now that song is stuck in my head, too.
I tried. Guess you're going to have to talk to the next guy. He should be here in 30 minutes.
I'm going back to bed. If I wake up and there's another ghost in my room, I'm going to scream. Huh? Oh, by the queen, I'm going to call the police.
That won't achieve anything, Mr. Scroogeroni. I paid him off. See, we have an understanding.
I suppose you are here to tell me how great Christmas is, too?
Of course, Mr. Scroogeroni. It's the best time of the year for me and my associates. We own the toy stores, you see. Santa is a good friend of mine.
Bah, humbug. Humbug! That makes me feel so much better, knowing the Sicilians own Christmas. Seems like you're the only ones who enjoy this time of year.
Don't worry, Mr. Scroogeroni. Old Donna Chris's present is going to show you why you should agree with my opinion. And if that don't work well, you'll be spending Christmas in the harbour.
Oh. Okay, then. I suppose I don't have a choice. Fine. Do it.
I'm glad you're so agreeable, Mr. Scrooge.
Please, just call me Scrooge.
Scrooge, away we go. See, now these are some real Christmas enjoyers. Pay attention, Scrooge.
Why, that's Bob Cratchit. My assistant. Oh, is that his son? He works so hard to afford his medication. Poor Tiny Tim.
Merry Christmas, Tim. I do hope you're enjoying the party. I know it ain't much, but...
It's enough for me, sir.
Oh, God bless you, Tiny Tim. God bless us all.
God bless you, sir.
Ah, what you hope that is getting you, Tiny Tim?
I hope to get a PS5, 3 sets of sneakers, new AirPods...
Ah, God damn it, Tiny Tim.
Oh, that Tiny Tim. What a scoundrel. I know he'll be like me when he grows up. The boy's got ambition, after all.
Yeah, when he grows up. He'll definitely be able to afford his medication with that poverty wage you're paying Mr. Cratchit.
Wait a minute. Are you suggesting that I pay my employees more? That's even funnier than Tiny Tim.
Your heart is cold, Scrooge. Clearly I haven't been getting through to you. Time for you to go back home.
Humbug! I'll bet that Bob set you up to this. What's next? Is he going to unionize?
Clearly I haven't gone through to his thick skull, Mr. Scrooge. My associate will be here soon. He won't be as hospitable to you as your and your close-minded ways.
I will not get out of bed then this time. Solve that humbugging problem.
You're breaking my heart, Mr. Scrooge. Hope you like concrete shoes.
No, go away. I'm not getting out of bed. You can take your whole moral lesson, double it, and give it to the next person. I said go away. What the dickens? A figure in a black cloak. Could it be? No, no, no. Still not getting out of bed. You can't make me. Nuh-uh. I am going back to sleep now. Thank you, and goodbye. Eh? What? A graveyard. What is the meaning of this? Oh, look. It's Bob. But where is Tiny Tim? Oh. Oh, no.
Merry Christmas, Tiny Tim. We miss ya. We all do. I miss you most. You're my favorite. Perhaps if that miserable old miser gave you that Christmas bonus, I could have bought your medication. I'm so, so sorry, Tim.
What have I done? What have I done? No. No, it's not my fault. I'm not to blame. It's Cratchit's. He should have... How could it be? I... forgotten. After all I have done for this dirty town. No, this cannot. No, it's real. This will not be how Scrooge is remembered. Groucho, my boy! Open up! Scrooge Reno has something for you!
Oh, Mr. Scrooge! What a pleasant surprise! I'll be in for my shift later, and I promise I won't be too drunk.
Cratchit, you take the day off. Full pay, hell, overtime even. Take Boxing Day off too. It's Christmas, you should relax.
Huh? What have you done with the real Scrooge?
I've had a change in heart. I see it now. It's Christmas, and I was making you work a full shift. How shameful that behavior was. Unacceptable, even. Now I'll be on my way. Merry Christmas, Cratchit.
Oi! You're more than welcome to join in on the partying if you want. We have coleslaw.
Coleslaw? Eh? Surely I have work. Then again, it is Christmas. You're on, Cratchit.
That's the spirit, Mr. Scrooge. God bless you, sir.
God bless us all, Bob.
Well, there you have it. Glad we had a happy ending, Matthew. I wasn't too sure when the Mafia showed up. Well done to Tig, Ronan and Casper.
Absolutely. All's well that ends well, Stevens. And in fact, speaking of endings, it's nearly time for us to wrap up here on episode one of this year's PBC podcast. Before we play out with our much anticipated finale, a few words of thanks. Firstly, to all the lads on the podcast module, to all our contributors on this episode who gave their time to come in and record. Humphrey Porter and Eamon McCarthy must be mentioned here, but also to Mr. Bohan and Mr. Kavanagh for their time and patience. Huge thanks to also to incredible staff here in Prez for their time and patience in allowing us to take time from classes when we needed to work on this.
A big thank you to PBC Management also, of course, for their continued support and encouragement of PBC Podcast. And finally, of course, to Elaine Smith for sound production and Mr. Olinchig, who produces the show.
Absolutely, Stephen. Hear, hear. Episode 2 is now in production, dear listeners, but from episode 1, it's time to say goodbye. Now speaking of the incredible staff here in the school, they recently banded together to record a classic Christmas hymn to sing us out, with teacher Mary O'Driscoll on violin, six-year Liam Ring on guitar, junior students Daniel Shorten and Jack McCann singing the opening verse, and our guidance counsellor Kirsty O'Flynn conducting. Here are the staff of PBC with Silent Night. My name is Matthew Redden.
And my name is Stephen Delaney.
This has been Episode 1, Season 4 of PBC Podcast.
Happy Christmas everybody.
Lord, at thy birth, Jesus, Lord.